suggest you look into it. Getting back to Paul, they've used different mediums for testing the concept of Zenik waves. I think the primary one that Wesley was mentioning earlier was the surface of water. The idea being that you could use the higher surface of the Earth as a kind of a plane that Zenik type of waves just are planar waves that don't manifest in 1 over r squared attenuation.
I'm sorry. The two boy in Earth upper load does not provide waveguides. Memorize that, please. There is a different mechanism standing about it. Inverse square law applies to the wave in the free space. That's the first thing. The second thing is there are three types of interfaces. One is dielectric and dielectric, which is used in electronics today. And those two dielectrics are supposed to have a different dielectric constant. The other one is conductive medium and the dielectric. And that could be physical dielectric or that could be a gas, which is the air. And the third one is partial conductive medium, which is air, and dielectric. And that could be slab of dielectric or that could be air as a dielectric. The only difference between surface plasma, polaritron, and the Zenik wave, and any way that you can imagine to bring into it is frequency. It is just a certain interface is for a certain frequency good. An interface is nothing long, nothing different than the waveguide. And waveguides we know for hundreds of years. I mean, I'm joking. But anyhow, it's just a plus waveguide. And to XVS.
Okay, Roy, thanks. That's what I wanted to know, what kind of medium this thing's going through. Not like a radio wave through a vacuum.
Okay,
back to you, Roy.
One more thing. It's supposed to be in TM mode, transverse magnetic mode. That's the only way that it's going to go into the interface.
Okay, thank you, Wesley, and I'm glad that Wesley was able to answer your question, Paul. Let's move off this subject into something else. Raymond, if you're still with us, KD2BYY, what's your question or comment for tonight? Well, I guess Raymond stepped away. Let me just ask if David, KG2RY, is here. I told him that he was going to get the first slot, but he wasn't around. So, David, if you're still out there, push down that push-to-talk button. Okay, nothing heard, but we'll move on down. Dan, WA1YYQ, I hope you're still with us.
Yes, I'm still here, Roy, listening to the conversation. It's WA1YYQ. I'm up here in Greenwich, Connecticut. Do you remember I came in a couple of weeks ago discussing the engine noise in my car and SWR issues?
Yes, I do. I hope you have a happy ending to that story.
Well, I have half a happy ending. What I was able to figure out, Roy, was very interesting. I did have Mercedes put on the ground straps on the exhaust system in two places, and it did not make a difference. And as you remember, the front straps to the hood didn't make a difference, and the straps on the trunk didn't make a difference. And this is SWR. I did get rid of quite a bit of noise by grounding the tailpipes to the frame. Let me just drop out and come back. So I found these items called MAT50s, MAT-50. They're made by Harvest, and they're also made by Diamond. Walmart sells them, but Diamond doesn't sell them in the United States. And what these are counterpoise magnet mats for cars. And what I was able to figure out after I bought two of them was that my trunk lid is not made of a material that can reflect or a solid metal. The only metal part of the car... It seems to be the back quarter panels, and not the bumpers, not the trunk, not the hood, not even the front quarter panels are made of some metallic where the magnets would stick to it. So what I did is I connected them to the base of the antenna, which is in the center of the trunk, in the center lip of the trunk, and I inserted them inside the trunk above, where right below the trunk, but above the material that is against the roof of the trunk, and sure enough, I could tune perfectly.
So that was the solution? You needed to kind of put a little bit more metal into your car?
It seemed to be the solution. When I was at Mercedes, they actually allowed me to go back into the bay and figure out, and they showed me that the car has two sets of rubber bumpers that prevent it from grounding throughout the car. So what I needed to do, and I'm going to put more metal in there, is that the trunk is made of a carbon fiber. It's a product that doesn't conduct electricity or reflect. There's nothing to it. So, and the same with the hood. And that's why I wasn't getting a good ground plane. So yes, right under my diamond, I just don't want to cut out here. Under my diamond S330, which is connected to a lip mount with the diamond mount, I now have connected these to the base of the mount for the ground, and I've inserted them into the sides, which now creates this ground plane underneath this carbon material, so it goes right through it, and I'm using the tunematic that Mike makes, and it's working like a charm. I can't tell you how great it's working. I drive down, I'm getting 80 all the way to 80 all the way to 17 meters, with automatic tuning with 1-to-1 or 1.2 SWRs all the way through. It was a charm. Noise levels went down. But let me just continue. So I got an FT891 from Yaesu and put it in the car, and that is made specifically for mobile versus my 991A or the other radios. And it has a very good noise reduction. That helps me. It's actually got three variables to it, so I was able to tune it to a level where I can hear good signals, and it wasn't garbled, and it just made the trick. So the answer, Roy, is that it needed a ground plane in the back behind the antenna to complete the cycle of the of radials, so that the radiator can work effectively. And I just worked south of Miami this morning, driving up 95 from the Botanical Gardens this afternoon.
82 GS. Well, that's great. I'm so glad to hear that you worked it out. I'm curious. It's a shame we don't have anyone on the air that has a Tesla, because I think Teslas are kind of made out of similar type of composite carbon. We live in a weird time that a lot of cars aren't necessarily made out of metal. Not that it's not ferromagnetic, that it doesn't stick to magnets. There are a lot of metals out there that are not ferromagnetic. There are some types of stainless steels that do not stick to magnets. The aluminum certainly doesn't. So there's a lot of fine conductive material that would act as a wonderful ground plane. But if you're using carbon fibers that are probably dipped in epoxy, so each individual one of them is sealed up in a non-conductive way, you got a whole lot of plastic and other things rather than a whole lump of metal. So that makes perfect sense to me, and I thank you for telling us this.
Yeah, great. Thank you. It's been, Roy, a several-month project of aggravation trying to figure this out, but doing some research and finding out what these materials were that actually, it looks like metal to me, but it's not. And so anyway, I was able to solve that problem, and I'm very happy to say I solved that problem. I still have the engine noise on 40 meters. I'm going to work on that. I'm still talking to the techs to get some more information about it, but I don't think I'm going to be able to do anything to fix that. and at this point, it's very livable. Between the radio, the antenna working, maybe a little bit of engine noise now, it's workable. So I just wanted to share that with you, and I thank you for letting me come in tonight.
Okay, very good. And now I know about Diamond Mat 50. I have it up on my browser when I have a chance. I'll take a look at it and learn something. That's the mark of a good episode of our technical mess, when we all take something away that we didn't come up with at first. So I thank you once again.
Okay, Roy, very good, very good. Yeah, they're very interesting pieces, and like I said, they don't sell them in the United States. Diamond manufacture them outside of the United States in Japan, but not here. But Walmart sells them, and there's also somebody on eBay that sells them, and also, there are some YouTube videos of foreigners, not United States videos, who are showing how it works with their radios when they slap them on their cars. So anyway, there's a lot of information out there about it. I never heard of these things before. I would have never thought about it. One of my friends actually saw it and asked me if that might be helpful, and I ordered them just to see, and boy, did that solve the problem. Anyway, 73 Roy, just wanted to say that, and I'm still working on the engine noise. If I come through with any breakthroughs on that, I'll be back on the net. So I don't want to hog it anymore. 73, you have a good night. Everybody out there, have a good night and a good week, and I'll be back again. This is WA1YYQ in Greenwich, Connecticut. 73.
Okay, 73. And thanks for telling us this. So we learned something new, Dan, and please come back again. Who knows? Maybe you'll hear some question that you know the answer for, so you could supply more answers, or question comes up, whatever. You're always welcome here.
Okay, thank you, Roy. 73. Good night, everybody.
Okay, next on my list is Ed, K2GJE. You said you had a small comment. Please, what would that be?
K2GJE. I just happened to this week go to ac2gs.com. You got some fantastic articles there that everybody should read. A little bit of plus for you. I have one question at the moment, though, that while I was listening, if you pick up at a flea market a directional coupler and it has a frequency range on it, can you go up or you can go down? Over.
It was my understanding that if you go past that range, it is not going to be in the calibration range for the equipment. That doesn't mean that you can't use it by correcting for that if you have a known measuring device and can convert it from that frequency from that design to another. In other words, if something is rated for HF, and you want to use it theoretically, I guess, for VHF, I think it's possible. It's not the perfect solution, but it's possible to take that with a calibrated VHF watt meter and record the results and build your own little conversion table to use at the non-rated frequency. It's not as good as having one designed for that frequency, but I that's my understanding of how you could sort of get away with that. If anyone else has any opinions out there, please feel free to add them. Gosh, none of our knowledgeable electrical engineers want to throw their 2 cents worth into this question?
Can you repeat the question again?
Yes, Ed's question was, if you have a directional watt meter that's rated off frequency to what you want to measure, can you get away with it if it's under the frequency that it's designed for, over the frequency it's designed for? And it was my understanding that both will introduce inaccuracies you can calibrate it with a watt meter that's designed for that frequency and interpolate the values you get from the meter into a more accurate assessment. But I don't think that, say, a directional watt meter that's designed for VHF, you can use without any correction either in UHF or in HF. If it's designed and calibrated for VHF, it's designed and calibrated for VHF.
The answer is no. I have many trying to find types that I have especially purchased for the low frequencies from 30 kilohertz to megahertz. This is the old one, but by Bali Engineering Limited type 30K-20. And I have a micro hatch 711N. Then I have a 706 from the same company. And I have a bird meter, I believe it's 43, right? Hold on. Number, manufacturer, part number, contract. No, it doesn't say the number on it. But anyhow, I was using a different kind of slug in it, and I was changing it to the auto frequency. It doesn't work. And I was trying to HF or VHF and reverse. It doesn't work. You have either no reading at all or some mistaken reading. So, for an example, if I take N2XGN, if I take the one that works from 30 kilohertz to megahertz, if I go to 10 kilohertz, which I have a transmitter for it especially, then it shows me about 60% of the power, but it's not linear. If it was linear, it could be working. I'm not sure, but maybe some of the ham radio operators know that bird with improper slug, when you put a different slug on it that is not on the frequency, would that have a linear error or not? And to actually...
Well, I mean, again, my assumption is that it would not have a linear relationship. That is why you would have to kind of plot the correction factor across a wide range of power ratings for a given off-label frequency. I think Dick used to mention this. You can't take it to extremes because the non-linearity of the whole thing just goes completely crazy when you get to certain extremes of frequency. But, you know, I think there's ways to interpolate without introducing too much error. But again, anyone out there with any comments, observations, knowledge on this, please feel free.
WYQ, is it really okay?
Yeah, I mean, it's about 30% noise, but I can understand you.
Okay, I believe what you can do is you take the directional coupling to greatest for some bands, almost without any problem at all, at lower frequencies, provided, like you say, you recalibrate. What's going to happen in most directional couplers is the coupling coefficient is going to increase as the frequency drops. For example, a 20 dB directional coupler at 2 MHz, if that's the low end of the frequency, why not use it down at 1 MHz, it might be instead of the 20 dB coupler or 26 dB coupler. You can calibrate that out. Going low in frequency can be done. Let me drop a second. The problem might be if you try to go too high above the cutoff frequency, something called dispersion. You'd like to believe that the coupling port or the sampling port of the directional coupler and the point of where you're going to do the measurement, whether it be at the output or at the input, want to be at the same phase. And if the frequency is low enough, they're close enough together so that they don't have much phase shift between them. If the frequency increases, you get dispersion. So you get an error vector between what you're trying to measure and what you're trying to do with samples, and it may not be as correctable as you think. It might be okay for certain degrees of VFWR, but if you put too much of a mismatch on there, those phase errors are going to be probably not being able to calibrate that. You can probably go 10-20% higher than cutoff, but I'm not sure what's going to happen too much above that. You may not be able to calibrate it much beyond that the other way. That's my opinion anyway. WIT.
Okay, very good, Mike. Sounds, makes perfect sense to me. Ed, does it make sense to you? So basically, you, it'll be off calibration, but it will be usable if you have a known calibrator available at some point. It's much easier to go lower frequency than higher frequency. As you get higher, you're going to reach a limitation where it's going to be impossible to calibrate.
K2GJ, okay, the conclusion I come to, it might be nonlinear, but with a dummy load and various other loads, you can always calibrate the SWR with 50 ohms, with 25 ohms, with 100 ohms, and you'll probably be close enough that you can use it down in frequency. But evidently some problems happen if you try to go up in frequency. But I would think that up in frequency you would get more coupling between the pickup and the conductor. I don't know. Just a thought on my part. Over.
Any thoughts on that, Mike? You mentioned the phase problem.
Yes, it's right in a way. It depends on the kind of direction of coupler design you're using. If you have a two-line approach where you have a main line and closely coupled to it, there's a pickup line with a termination on the other end, he's quite correct. The capacitive reactance between the two lines is going to decrease, and the coupling is going to increase. Unfortunately, so is the surgeon's phase, and that's the problem. Not that I'm worried too much about the coupling increase. That by itself could be calibrated out if it wasn't for the error vector at the surge. That's the one that probably would be difficult to calibrate.
Okay, very good. So I thank you, Mike, for your participation. And Ed, it was a very interesting question. Certainly. 2 cents, 5 cents, 10 cents, whatever you got, Wesley.
Okay, we want to really measure. Forget about one method of measurement. There are older SWR meters, or power meters, and one of them is Micromatch Model 711N. It was made by MC Jones Electronics CO Incorporated, Bristol, Connecticut. This one is interesting because it starts from 30 watts, and it goes to 300 watts for both reflected and forward. It has a connection, sort of telephone jack, that you could use for remote indicator, that could be your oscilloscope, and much more accurate, and you can switch the power. Now the good thing about it is that based on manufacturer, it works from 25 megahertz to 1 gigahertz. So actually, the 25 megahertz, and I measured it on 18 megahertz, it was pretty accurate. Now the accuracy is 5% full scale. So if somebody can get a hold on that model 711N, now, without using BIRD, which this one I believe I pick up for $5 or $10 on the Humphreys, they could give you the maximum 300 watts on the frequencies from, 18 megahertz to 1 gigahertz. It's pretty accurate, amazingly accurate. And the reason that accuracy happened is because it is using little different form of measuring forward and reflected entry clear.
Okay, very good, Wesley. So people, look out for a model 711N and tell me if you found it and how much it cost you. There's lots of interesting tools out there. I think the majority of people who have directional watt meters tend to have birds or something very similar. I'm very pleased. It's my oldest piece of equipment. I tell people I've only been in this hobby for 10 years, and all my radios were built this particular century. The one piece of equipment I have from the 20th century is a bird watt meter that used to belong to good old John, KC2WGB, and when he passed away, I purchased this from his daughter, and it's a lovely, lovely piece of equipment. So most people, I think, who are interested in directional watt meters tend to have a bird these days, but for you other guys, if you can snag a 711N, try to do that.
Forget about one more thing.
Yes, Wesley.
I have a 400 watt one, and this one is absolutely unique. It's model 706. Now what it has two switches, one switch and one potentiometer. The switch gives you forward, reflected, calibration, and VSWR, VSWR. Oh, if you repeat, Dr. Roy, how you pronounce it? Now, apart from that switch, it does have on the right-hand side calibrate potentiometer. So, this one is good because you can calibrate it without any additional tools, without making marks on it at all. It is right on the money. This is model 706 from the same company, Micromatch, made by M.C. Jones Electronics Co., probably 1966. I remember if anyone from you remember the music from that time. N2XGA.
I am sure that a lot of people who frequent the repeater are well aware of the music of the 1960s. Ask them if they're well aware of the music of the 2020s, you might not get so much. But of the 1960s, certainly. And the way I've heard most people pronounce it, including Dick, was Vizwa.
Vizwa. Vizwa. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wesley. So that was a fascinating discussion. Let me try one more time the two people that I have on my list who apparently stepped away from the radio. First, David, KT2RY. If you're out there, hit the push to talk button. Oh, well, maybe next week. The other gentleman was Raymond, KD2BYY. Are you out there, Raymond? Oh, well, I guess neither of them stuck around. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. We have a couple more minutes left. I will open the topic space for anything to do with science, technology, medicine. Once again, we do not treat, diagnose people, but if you want a general discussion on the topic and you have a question, please hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Going back to the cause that have parts that aren't made of metal, that used to be a problem, I think it was the mid-80s, and through the 90s, with the satin. All the different satin models had plastic parts, plastic trunks, plastic, the hoods, including the roof. So, you'd buy the car, you think you were going to put a mag mount on top of it, and it wouldn't stick. I mean, a different kind of problem than what he's having with the Mercedes, but
yeah, you never know. You think you're gonna buy something and not thinking about what the roof is made of. So you go to clip on a mag mount, you'd have a problem. The same for the trunks. But they used to clip them on, but they must have did something similar. They must have ran, I don't remember any stories, but they must have ran wires underneath and attached them to the trunk or something to give some kind of grounding off of that. I know it's a problem. I just, you know, they even have a couple of articles in there, QSC, relating to the Saturn automobile. Back to you.
Yeah, those go back to the good old days when they were desperately trying to get their mileages up, and they were doing everything, including the kitchen sink, and using lightweight equipment materials. Were they plastic or were they fiberglass? Because I remember a lot of problems with fiberglass car covers, messing up people's ability to use antennas and such.
Might have been fiberglass. You know, we just call them plastic. But I don't know the exact makeup of it. I had a Dodge truck with a fiberglass gas tank back in the 70s. So, you know, fiberglass was around. But I thought they were using PVC. It's the ring bell for the year Saturn. They were trying to compete against the Japanese. They were going nuts at that time, building cars. And the Saturn was made all here in the USA, you know, all of it. So that was their way of competing. And to bring the price down, from what I understand, it was PVC. But it might have been fiberglass. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, nowadays the magic material is carbon fiber. I understand that there was a delay in the manufacture of Teslas because it was originally engineered to have some other material, and good old Elon decided that it had to be carbon fiber, and I think that delayed them something like a year. I don't know if there's any Tesla fans out there who remember that little bump in the road.
Okay, very good. You know, I mean, it was a change. You know, if you had a convertible, of course, you were out. Some of those convertibles had actually hard tops that would come out of the back. You know, you couldn't easily attach, you know, a 2-meter, clip to the trunk there either. There's always going to be problems with the automobiles, but the hams managed to get around them one way or another. Pretty crafty. Back to you.
Yeah, we have ingenuity on our side and our brother and sister hams to help us out if we can't suss it out. So, everything's a little bit of a challenge these days as they were before. So thanks, Paul. Anyone else with any questions or comments tonight before we call this segment to an end? Okay, then I'll take this opportunity once again to remind everyone that if you want to reach me via email, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. My link page, please take a look at it. I thank Ed for mentioning it. I put it together week by week, and it stays available to everyone 24/7. It goes as far back as I think to 2017, 2018. So take a look. There are some very interesting articles, some pretty pictures, and what have you. And if people like puzzles, not exactly the puzzles that we handle here, but more of the amateur radio technology-based quizzes. I also maintain a puzzle page. It's a little different. It's puzzle.kc2rc.com, and that has a year's worth of puzzles. It gives you the question, and then the answer is invisible until you basically bold it by click and spreading your cursor through it and it becomes visible. So take a look at that as well. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. Also want to remind everyone that we have an audio stream of W2VL available 24/7 or as close to that as possible. If you aren't near a radio and you want to listen to what's going on in the repeater, just point your browser at technet.ac2gs.com and that'll give you a audio stream. And as always, want to remind everyone that MikeKC2NJI has a great archive of technical nets that go as far back as September 2006. His website is amateurradio.tv. He's gotten, at this point, more than a million. And it's a very, very useful feature, the wisdom of many amateur radio operators that have come and unfortunately gone and become silent keys. So keep that in mind. So thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I'll be back a little later, but now it's time for Paul and the SpaceNet report.
ESWS2N. Okay, a few things that are happening. Space. Nothing as dramatic as some of these commercial either suborbital or orbital flights that have been happening lately, like Inspiration 4. I got back and in one piece, and which was good. You know, to have four people go up with an autonomous spacecraft. Launch and come back then, you know, 3 days later and land safely in the Atlantic Ocean was real accomplishment. And good to see that one okay. And they plan on doing at least one more of those in the not too distant future. But the next flight up will be another crew flight to the space station. They'll send up another four. NASA will, you know, have the be paying for that, and SpaceX will do the launch with Falcon 9 and the crew vehicle, and they'll attach to Harmony node, the in front of that, they have the docking port on pressure mating adapter 2, and they'll be able to bring the crew from temporarily from 7 people up to 11. And that will last for a couple of weeks until an existing four people that have been up there for 6 months come back and land either in the Atlantic Ocean or the Gulf of Mexico, depending on weather conditions. And they'll be back to 7 on board the space station for another 6 months. But they do have to get ready for a Soyuz launch, which is coming up in October as well. That replaces three people, not four. But the Soyuz, that will be coming up, they want to dock that to the existing RASVET module, which is part of the Russian side of the space station. It's facing down, you know, toward Earth all the time, and they plan on docking with that. The problem is there's a spacecraft already attached to it right now, a manned spacecraft, the Soyuz, attached with, you know, which normally carried Mark Van de Heil, which is a ham, KG-5 GMP, as well as two Russians up to that space station back in March. So they need to relocate that one to have it free, you know, for docking. They're not ready to leave, so the spacecraft itself, Soyuz, will pull out from RASVET, and it will dock with the new Nyoker module that was attached a couple months ago. You might remember that was the one that gave them all the trouble. It's a large module, so one of the it's the same size as one of the big modules that Russia has attached now, the Zvezda module. It's about that same size. It's 44 feet long and, you know, 16 feet in diameter. And that was the one they had problems with the thrusters going off unexpectedly, which wound up spinning the whole space station around, which is like you know, the space station is as long as like a 30-story building right now. It would be like all of a sudden turning a whole 30-story building
you know, not only upside down, but, you know, 1.5 turns completely by the time they got that under control. Anyway, they did get it under control, and they've even done a spacewalk, an EVA, to start hooking up different connections, data connections, power connections. Take the power off from the existing ISS power grid, you know, with these big solar panels that take up almost like an acre of property to supplement the power inside of Nokia. Nokia also gets, you know, power from itself. It has solar panels as well, but eventually they'll be all taking the power from the American side and just use the Russian side as a backup. So, you know, and now this new crew that's coming up, like I said, will attach to RASFET, and the, right now they're going to relocate this existing one to it. To do that, they take all three members, all three crew members, Mark. And they fly over to the new module. And a lot of people wonder why do they do that? And it's for the safety reasons. You always have to have a seat on board for everybody that's on board the space station in case there's an emergency, a fire, you know, gets hit with the media or something like that. So, you know, if you just, you know, one Russian could take it, you know, the commander for that three-person vehicle could easily go in there by himself and relocate the module by himself. But in that time frame, in that maybe two-hour time frame when he's disconnected, you would have an extra two people on board the station with no seat in case it was an emergency. It would be toast. So that's the reason they do it. They've done that many times. I think over the years they probably relocated spacecraft of different types, maybe 20 different times. Nothing new. We'll see how that goes. And that'll be happening this Tuesday. And they'll be getting ready for the October crew that's coming up. Early portion of the net. Okay, nothing heard. There's a rover that NASA is having. They're building to go to the moon called the Viper. I think I've talked about it before on the net. Anyway, it's called the Viper, which is acronym for Volatiles Investigating Polar Exploration Rover. So it's a rover, maybe as big as Opportunity or Spirit that we're riding on Mars for, in one case, 14 years. The difference is it's going to be a four-wheel vehicle, not a six-wheel vehicle. It'll be similar to those two in its power. It's going to be powered by solar panels. It's going to have chemistry testing on board. The idea is to drive around and, first of all, look for ice, number one. But they also want to drill into rocks and check the mineralogy in the rocks, maybe some of the soil. The idea is to get a good idea of where everything is located when eventually we start landing people on the moon, back on the moon. This thing has the capability of riding around 15 miles or so, wherever it lands. It could go to different locations. And they plan on landing this thing. You know, they know the exact place it's going to land. The Noble crater or region is where they're going to land, which is very close to the South Pole. Have like the Shackleton crater down there, and which is like right on the South Pole, and it's just off to maybe even touching that crater, and that's where the Noble crater is. And they now know that's the exact location when this thing takes off in 2023. It will land there and do all the research, especially looking for ice. They know from all the orbiting spacecraft that have flown over there, and LaCrosse,
spacecraft that actually crashed into the South Pole and shot ice up into the air. It was documented by another spacecraft. It's been tested even by Chandraya number 2, which is an Indian, country India that has a orbiting spacecraft. Been tested by our own orbiting spacecraft that was launched in 2009 and still functioning for the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So they know it's there, but now they want to pinpoint exactly where it's there, where it is. So they're going to use this thing. If you go down to the South Pole, where Viper is going to land, it tends to stay light almost all the time. If you landed where Neil Armstrong landed, or any of the other 5 missions that landed on the moon, they were all pretty much equatorial, maybe even a little north of that. It usually has 14-day nights, 14-day days, 14-day nights, 1 month around the globe. On the South Pole, it's different. Depending on the season, it tends to be in light most of the time. It's not bright. If you're standing there and you look for the sun, it's always going to be on the horizon. It's never going to be directly overhead, as if you were on the equator of the moon. But the idea is, since the sun is always hitting that area, if you drive to, let's say, a high place, maybe the edge of a crater, when it does go into its dark period, which is usually no more than 4 days in that part of the moon, this thing will be able to survive the night. It will have heat pipes on it, which is, little pipes that go from, different heaters on the spacecraft, and the heat radiates and goes to different parts of the rover. Keeps certain parts, continually warm. Generally, they do that with plutonium on board, but they don't need that. They'll have actual heaters that will come on when needed. There will be, like I said, solar panels. Vehicle, and I think it could generate up to 4 kilowatts. Wow, that's like my generator for the house. I don't have a big generator, but it's good enough to run stuff. Their system, I can run ham radios, I can run refrigerators, TVs, a bunch of lights, no problem. Even a small air conditioner. That should be plenty of power for this. For this rover, it has the capability of driving around for like 15 different miles. It can go much quicker than Spirit and Opportunity. Those things usually went around a couple of centimeters a second, and that's like a crawl. Maybe in one day they could do full blast in one direction without stopping. I think they could go a couple hundred feet. Viper will be able to easily double that. Anyway, that gets launched in 2023. Launched on by SpaceX. They'll use their Falcon Heavy. They call it the FH Falcon Heavy, which is instead of like one Falcon 9 rocket, it's 3 Falcon 9 rockets that are bolted together into one, creating around over 5 million pounds of thrust. So they'll launch with that rocket and essentially land the South Pole area. And that's eventually where the people will go when Artemis finally gets off the ground, if it ever does. First unmanned launch will be theoretically the end of this year, but now they've already switched that to first part of next year. And then that will be unmanned. That will go around the moon. Then Artemis 2 will also go around the moon. But with the crew this time, they just won't land. Fly back using the heat shield and land and come back to Earth that way. But Artemis 3 has their plan right now is still to have Artemis 3 with people land on the moon on the south part of the moon. And when they do, they'll
probably meet up with Viper. Viper will be there, and by that time it'll give them all the information that, that they'll probably need. And that will be the beginning, after many, many fights of crews going to the south part of the moon, theoretically, you'll be able to set up a small base there. And with the help of Viper, Viper will be looking for ice buried in craters that never see daylight. Although the South Pole is lit up pretty much most of the time, except for 4 days a year, 4 days a month, they have deep craters, and craters never see daylight. So the idea is there's probably ice down there that's been frozen for billions of years. They'll be able to mine that out somehow eventually, heat it up. Now you have water, either to drink, use electrolysis. Now you have oxygen to breathe. You have hydrogen, which could burn. You could use that as a fuel for maybe fuel cells in your base that you're set up in the south part of the moon. Or you could take that hydrogen and use it for fuel in a rocket ship along with the oxygen that you manufacture on the moon, put that in a rocket ship, and you'd have a easy way to launch yourself off the moon without bringing everything with you from Earth. And it all starts in 2023. So the reason I bring it up now is that NASA has finally decided that proper location for this thing. It'll be launched on top of a lander. The rover is just a rover. The rover will be sitting on top of a lander. It's called the Griffin lander. And that's being built. The Griffin system is being built by Astrobiotic. Astrobiotic is a company that their goal originally was to be the first one to land something on the moon and win the Google Prize of, you know, $10 million. That didn't work out, but they continued on. And they're going to supply anybody, NASA, private companies, whoever, a way to transport equipment, or in this case a rover, to the lunar surface. Griffin will the landing vehicle. Again, all launched by a Falcon Heavy. Goes to the moon, the Griffin vehicle decelerates, lands on the moon. Sitting on top of this thing is Viper the rover. And it's going to have a couple of ramps that's going to come down from the top of the Griffin vehicle and drive down and off it'll go on its mission to look for ice, drill into rocks, check the soil, all of the above. Any questions or comments, WS2N, name is Paul. Okay. Nothing heard. There's going to be another spacecraft launched by the by a Falcon Heavy rocket here as well. Another one of these deals where you have three Falcon 9 boosters bolted together, pulling 27 engines to launch this other vehicle called Psyche. Psyche will launch from Florida, Launch Complex 39A, on a Falcon Heavy launch vehicle. And that's going to be solar powered as well. I believe this thing gets 4.5 kilowatts of power from the solar panel. Psyche's mission will be to fly out to the asteroid belt and find an asteroid with the same name, Psyche. It's supposed to be a big metal type of asteroid. Theoretically, maybe the core of what would have been another planet if it had formed. I'm thinking that, you know, the center of our planet would have been metal. This thing is going to be a big chunk of metal. It's around 140 miles in diameter, so maybe a little length of Long Island. That would be the diameter. Anyway, this thing is supposed to orbit that. Like I said, it's going to probably launch around the same, probably 2023, I think, or so. And the idea is to fly it out to out the psyche to do that. You know, this isn't just going to be a flyby. If it was, they could get by maybe just with one rocket sending it out there, you know, one, instead of a Falcon Heavy. They could do a flyby and do, you know, all the instrumentation that they can, and that would be it. But because they want to orbit it, they plan on putting Hall thrusters, Hall ion thrusters, in this case, four of them. That will be the most that we ever put on board. I think OSIRIS-REx has three. But, yeah, and they're not real, you know, regular Hall thrusters. Hall thrusters are different than the grid type of thrusters that they use today. A Hall thruster has gone out to the moon in the Smart 1 vehicle. It's just that one. But this one's going to have four. And with four, you'll be able to have enough thrust if you, let's say, put a silver dollar down in your hand. It would have that kind of weight, which is a lot. You know, most of the ion thrusters have the weight of maybe a sheet of paper. So this thing's going to be able to get up to some acceleration. You never have to shut these things off. You know, when they're lit, you can leave them on. You know, not only days, but weeks, or maybe even years. And you can get up to, in this case, it's going to get up to around 200,000 miles an hour. And then eventually slow down. They'll face it the other way and keep the ion engines going. To eventually slow it down to a point where it's practically down to a crawl in relation to the asteroid Psyche, and eventually we'll go into orbit around that asteroid. So that's going to be pretty exciting when that all happens. And, you know, it will have literally over 2,000 pounds of xenon gas, you know, for the Hall thrusters. You know, what it does is it vaporizes the xenon. As it vaporizes it's like a plasma grid, instead of a grid with, you know, that's got a cathode attached to it. The plasma itself gets electrified, and that becomes the plasma, the conductor of the, all the ions, the heavy ions, protons that are now left in the xenon after it gets separated. Side of spacecraft, so the protons and with xenon, you have a lot of protons for every nucleus, so it's on the heavy side, so it's a great gas for ion engines, and that'll go flying out of the back a couple hundred thousand miles an hour, which will accelerate the vehicle. But that will be something to look forward to, see how they do this. All engines are coming a long way. They have more thrust than your standard grid system thrusters. So I don't have the slight destruction that happens to the other ion engines. Over time, they kind of start to wear down on the walls, different parts of it. All thruster, they don't wear down really at all. Metal grids are using some kind of gas, plasma, have magnetic walls, you know, keep the electrons and protons that might be flying free from hitting the walls, damaging the surface. Very reliable, the experimental ones have been going on for decades, and, you know, they've gotten to the point where they're comfortable not only using the ion core thrusters for an expensive, almost billion-dollar project like this, but they plan on putting them onto the new space station gateway that will be put around the moon, eventually be manned on a regular basis. Gonna trust that manned space station orbiting around the moon, which is a problem. You're not gonna be able to get to that space station anytime soon, like you could with the ISS. Gonna trust the thrust of the ion engines to help maintain that stable orbit that gateway will eventually be in. That was come a long way with ion thrusters. Any comments? This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet.
Okay, I know I've covered Lucy before, but I'll do it one more time. But in a couple of weeks, that thing's going to be launched on an Atlas V rocket with a 401 configuration, which means it'll have a 4 to first, 401 for first number is how many meter diameter the fairing is that covers the space fairing. In this case, 4. On the Atlas V, you can go up to a 5.
And you're going to have the, you know, 0 means that the middle number means that there won't be any solid booster rockets necessary to propel this thing off, you know, launch pad. And the one at the end, 401-1, means that you just have the one Centaur rocket from 20,000 pounds of thrust. That will be the second stage. And that's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. We're being launched on a 401 Atlas V. That's a rocket that uses RP-1 or rocket propellant 1. Commonly, that's a common name for it, but it's really refined kerosene that they use with oxygen. And that'll launch from Launch Complex 41 on Cape Canaveral. Same, actually, it's the same launch pad that the Starliner by Boeing should have been launching people by it now, but hasn't. Starliner is now, you know, behind schedule, unfortunately, due to thruster problems. They were ready to go a couple of months ago, but thrusters got jammed. They weren't open. You know, they have to be open all the way when they take off. The reason they got jammed is they took the hydrazine gas, somehow mitigated its way through through the metal gills, and got to the other side and started corroding the thruster chamber. And then now you have a problem with, you know, the valves won't open up. They're being hung up. They got to rebuild, I think, all those thrusters before they can launch. Anyway, getting you back to Lucy, Lucy will be launched October 16th. It'll be 5:30 in the morning, via 5:34 a.m. And that's going to take quite a few years to get to its destination. It's got two main destinations to go to. They're called Trojan asteroids. It'll be L4 and the L5 location. They're stable areas where these asteroids have been hanging out there for probably billions of years. The L4 and the L5. The L4 is, you know, as the planet Jupiter goes around the sun, it's in the forward area. If you draw a 90-degree triangle between the sun and Jupiter, the apex would be the location of these asteroids that they want to visit. No spacecraft has visited it yet. So that's the leading location. They call that L4, Lagrange Point 4. Then there's Lagrange Point 5, which is the lagging one. And that's also if you were to make an equilateral triangle between the Sun, Jupiter, and then the lagging point behind Jupiter, that would be the L5 location. There's more of these things there. So to investigate both, they'll first launch Lucy, you know, in orbit actually a couple of times. So they'll use the planet for an extra assist, some gravity assist, and eventually that will push them out to the spacecraft out to that location. So the first group would be the L4. I think that would be around, I forget what year, 2023 or so. I know the end. The last one would be 2033. That would be the L5. So halfway in between, you know, probably 4 or 5 years from now, it would make it to the L4 location. Lucy won't be orbiting, but it'll be going, photographing maybe four or five of these things, also with the instruments on board to figure out what they're made out of. Now, when it's done there, it'll blast its way out of the out of that location and go completely around the Earth again, and now, I mean around the Sun again. Until years later, it'll wind up going back to the L5 location to do the same thing all over again to find out what those asteroids are made out of. That's Lucy. And we'll see how Lucy does in a couple of weeks. Gets off the ground okay. Any comments or questions? WS2F. Nothing hurt. China is always in the news lately. They're really into that space program. So they just brought a crew back a couple of weeks ago. Now the station, that space station is unmanned. It could handle three people. But last week they sent up a cargo vehicle to the Tiangong space station. And it's a Tianzhu cargo vehicle, very similar to the Progress that the Russians have been using for decades. Autonomous, gets near its space station, docks the space station. Naturally right now there's nobody there to unload it. There is another docking column. And when the new crew goes up there, I'll be able to dock to that column, go inside, unload everything they need, and eventually they'll leave that attached and eventually load it up with junk. That will eventually use to deorbit and burn up over the South Pacific. New crew is almost ready, and in this case they'll be sending up one woman and two guys. They'll be the first female to dock with the new Tiangong space station. Had a female go up before, and it was Tiangong 1. They went up and had Tiangong 2. I think it's already deorbited, and now you have Tiangong 3, which right now is one big module. They plan on sending at least two more modules up within the next year or two. And each one is about the same size as this first one, so it will increase the size. And they have the option to keep going after that, but right now there is nothing being built as far as I know. So now you have two Earth space stations going around. And if Gateway gets off the ground, it's planned within the next, say, 4 years or so, to have another space station going around the moon. There's private companies looking to build space stations. Sierra Nevada, they plan on doing one. Axiom is going to eventually have their own modules attached to the front of the space station, our space station, International Space Station. And someday, when they say, well, it's time to deorbit our space station, all these new modules by Axiom will separate from the space station and become its own space station. And there's actual plans for that. But for now, Axiom is paying to have three people visit the International Space Station. That will be coming up soon, too. They'll dock with the space station and spend time on, you know, attached to the ISS maybe a couple of weeks. Go back into, they'll be using the Dragon crew vehicle to deorbit. They'll come back. And they'll be private tourists. Actually visit the space station. NASA will allow that. But they have to be trained. They have to be fully trained on what to do in emergencies, fires, and all that. So they'll be under the guidance of NASA. Or following the NASA rules before they're allowed to dock Axiom astronauts to the International Space Station. But that'll be coming up soon. We'll talk about that later in the future. So any questions or comments? Hey, talking about craters, another crater that was just named for Matthew Henderson, well, Henderson Crater on the Moon. What they did is used this fellow that used to hang out with Perry, before Perry actually went to the North Pole. So back in the late 1800s, guy would go on missions with Perry. And he was a minority. He was a black guy that had come out of Virginia. And he stayed with him for, I think they said, almost 20 years. So they got to the point where, I think it was 1909, where they made it to the North Pole. They say this guy, Henderson, Mapping Henderson, was the first guy to actually stand on the North Pole before Perry got there. Perry distance away at the time. Then they all made it down, and they also had some other people from the native community, the Eskimo type, that were with them. So, they had a whole group, and they made it to the North Pole at the same time. Sextants and everything else to make sure that they were at the exact location. And that's what they said. Anyway, this guy, Donna Matthew Henderson, they're naming a crater after him. Any questions, comments for this part of the net? Nothing hard. I really don't have anything else planned right now, unless somebody had a question. So I think maybe I'll end a little early, and we'll turn it over to Roy. We'll try to make tomorrow night's net, the info net, on these repeaters at 8:30, and that's always followed by the Swapper Shop, which I like listening to. You want to learn about old radios, you listen to the things that are sold on that, how much they cost, maybe what they cost at one time. But what I like to do is they'll name a radio and then grab a computer or a tablet or something and look up that particular radio. You can see what they're talking about. Always a good learning tool if you do it that way. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet.
Paul, Frank over on Echo Link, I think, has a question for you.
Okay, well, very good. We'll wait for Frank. No problem. I thought I was leaving enough space. Unlucky man, maybe he just keyed up. Hello, Frank.
Yeah, very good. When you drop this something else keys to appear quickly, maybe a radar sweeping through or something like that. I know that's a problem on Long Island sometimes. I'm kind of curious as to what the comm arrangement was, if we know for installation. It didn't sound like they were using the Starlink satellite. It sounded as if they were using a ground station network. Wondering if whose network they were using and what frequencies, whether it was NASA's DSN and their usual S-band downlinks or what. Go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't heard the bands or frequencies that they were using. They were using their own and communicating when they came over to, for ground stations. They said they could communicate most of the time by voice, but any a video that they did send down, they had to be over a ground station. So that tells me that they're probably using existing infrastructure and put their own stuff around the whole globe. So they might have been utilizing some of the NASA stations. I don't know if they were Deep Space Network. I doubt that. They don't need that. But, probably places like White Sands, New Mexico. I haven't heard them. They did say they had the capability of using TDRS. I heard that early on, a couple months ago, before they went up. and inspiration for. Yeah, the capability of working teachers. Now, teachers, Frank, they're tracking data in a relay satellite system. So maybe if there was a problem, they would have used that, but maybe they chose to keep off of it. In case there's problems, emergencies, we got to get back. They would be allowed to use, of course, anything. And they had plans on landing in different locations around the Earth in case there was a problem, but they had to come down early. So I haven't heard if it was S-band or not. But like you said, it probably is. And they're going to be doing this again. For now, they're going to take that globe out, that cupola that they use, put back the docking setup, and use that to dock the space station. The next crew that will be using Resilience, that's the name of that one. They have another spacecraft as well. But they realize that, there's a demand for this. So now Elon is planning on building at least another Dragon crew vehicle. And depending on the demand, maybe two more of them. But now he's got contracts, not only with NASA, to send their crews up to the space station. But now he's got these inspiration-type missions that people, these billionaires, I guess, are interested in. I guess I know there's one more that's supposed to be being planned. And not long from that, maybe 6 months or so. And then he's also got contracts, at least two contracts already with Axiom to send crews to the International Space Station, which they'll essentially be tourists as well. So the demand is there. Will the demand cut back if Starline ever gets off the ground? I don't know. But they plan on, Frank, but they plan on sending crews of four to the space station as well. And then, you wouldn't have the demand for SpaceX. So, we'll see how it goes. Back to you, Frank. WS2N.
Yeah, I remember they mentioned they were in 50, they put in a 51 degree inclination orbit, in part to maximize their ground station coverage. And not really sure what they were doing. I suspect they were using NASA's S-band network. I don't really know how much. Really, no, NASA had very much of that left, except for the three DSM stations. I don't think they maintain the other ground stations anymore. They used in Gemini, Apollo, and Skylab, or Mercury, Gemini, the whole first-generation space program network of ground stations. Anyway, very interesting. I guess at some point maybe we can find out more about what they did. I have another question for Roy when you're done here. WB2BXO.
WB2BXO. WS2N. And yeah, a lot of their equipment has been dismantled. They had probably, at least 18 sites around the globe, maybe more, I don't know. But even the one that was located on Merritt Island, they had the radar set up there to track the vehicles as they crossed as they left Florida. I mean, that was shut down, so Elon Musk said, okay, you're going to throw them away? I'll take them. Now, he took them, you can probably saw that on the internet a couple of years ago. Floated them down to, these are like dish radar antennas at one of the nearby facility on Merritt Island. Merritt Island is where Cape Canaveral and Cape Kennedy is. But he took those, and he's got them installed. I've seen him, pictures of it. He's got them actually installed in Boca Chica, Texas, where he's building the Starship. I'm going to let you ask Roy a question, and I'll just bow out for this evening. We'll be listening out, and we'll try, as always, to be back next week, 73. I'll turn it back to you, and then you can find, you know, go direct to CBS with AC2GS. WB2BXO, WS2N. Back to you, Frank.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that Punta Chica operation is nuts. It's going to be very interesting to see whether the FAA and other alphabet agencies really allow them to launch the Super Heavy from Boca Chica, or whether they insist that the operation be moved to the Cape even for the test flight. I would imagine that the government might prefer they launch the initial test for Boca Chica, only because they would rather that Elon blow up his own site rather than government-owned equipment. But anyway, Roy, my question was, and I'm not sure you know this, or know anything I can't look up, but do you know, have you played with your flex radio on FT8? I think you said you had, and whether you know the optimal power level to run it at, whether the flex radio can be run at the full 100 watts on FT8, or whether it's better off being cranked down to a lower power. Go ahead.
Yeah, Frank, as far as I'm aware, although it was originally designed to be a low signal strength transmission mode, people have abused it beyond belief. So theoretically, you can crank it up to 100 watts if you're so inclined. There are people who hook them up to linear amplifiers. There's no real problem as far as I can perceive with the amount of time that it's transmitting, because there are long pauses between, so the duty cycle is probably not going to be a problem at all.
I don't think duty cycle is a problem. I think distortion of the waveform is, like on PSK-31, where you have to crank the power down so that you're not distorting. Go ahead.
Well, again, as far as I'm aware, as long as you have a decent linear signal, you can't use non-linear amplifiers that are designed for FM. They're decidedly non-linear. But as long as you operate a linear device in the same way that single sideband works, you should be able to get away with it. I mean, I've heard people with ridiculous levels of power for FT8 that I don't think Joe Taylor was considering when he first brought it out. I haven't read any limitations. As long as you have a nice linear source of power, you can go as close to legal as you want.
Yeah, okay, very good. I'll check further. My impression is that for FT8, the fact that it's meant to be a low-power mode notwithstanding, that on most radios you're recommended not to be the power limit, because even with a linear final, apparently there can be a distortion issue. Anyway, I'll check into it further. Thanks, Roy. WB2BXO, back to net.
Okay. I mean, I will look as well. Could be wrong, but I distinctly recall anecdotal stories of people using ridiculous amounts of power. But I'll look into it further. Okay, well, it's 11:05. I want to thank everyone for tuning in for the Tony Award edition of the Limark Technical Net. I really appreciate that you people don't really care about the Tonys or the Emmys or the Oscars or any of those things. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much for participating. Please, we're going to do it all over again next Sunday night at 8 p.m., so please join me then. As I often do, Dick used to finish up his technical net with advice on the order of be kind to each other. It's always good advice, especially now. The virus is still out there. It can still bite us on the backside. So if you can't, if you have been vaccinated, great. If you can be vaccinated but haven't yet, or friends, family, enemies, whatever, neighbors, fellow employees, please ask them to pretty please be vaccinated. Maintain, you know, relative social distancing and masking when appropriate. Be smart, be safe, be well, and come back and join us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and I am officially closing this episode of the Limar Technical Net, and I am clear.
W2BL. Limar InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73.